The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to documentary filmmaker Bruce Donnelly, whose new production is Alambrones. That's Illuminations in English. It's an inside look at the art scene in modern Cuba. And yes, I use the term modern extremely loosely. Stick around and light 'em if you got 'em. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of supply-starved Cubano artists who will dazzle you with their wares in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Timing is everything, but not until recently if you were a Cuban fine artist. As displayed in Bruce Donnelly's new documentary, Alambrones, the Cuban art scene is a vibrant, enthusiastic national affair, tempered only by its lack of art supplies, like pencils and pens, or paper, canvas, or paint. The artists presented herein speak the same language as their counterparts in the free world, but they find that the tools of the trade that craftsmen around the world take for granted can be extremely hard to come by. But put proper paint and canvas in the hands of these spirited men and women, and you'll see eye-popping results, as fine as can be found in any American or European modern gallery. Alambrones comes on the scene in January 2015 on the unexpected wings of Barack Obama's historic decision to begin reopening trade and diplomatic relations with the island nation for the first time in more than 50 years. It's an opportunity that director Donnelly could not have seen coming while in production, but I have to imagine the prospects for it have only redoubled his enthusiasm for this project. Bruce Donnelly, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks very much.
I think I should have mentioned somewhere in that introduction that I'm coming to folks from St. Petersburg, 90 miles from Cuba, just in case you're thinking about setting up operations here. That's from the Chamber of Commerce. They'd like me to share that with you. Mm-hmm. They're making that big push. So, I mean, we have to start really by talking about the impact of Obama's efforts to reopen trade with Cuba for the first time in generations. I mean, this wasn't even a rumor when you started. How's it changed your approach to marketing Alambrones?
Well, the distribution companies behind us thought we somehow kind of, you know, facilitated this whole thing. You know? It was like, this is a perfect marketing kind of opportunity. That's pure coincidence, really, that all this is coming out. In fact, we had no idea, literally up to a week before the announcement, that this was happening. We returned from Cuba on December 5th. We were actually down there working on another project. There was no rumor of it. I certainly didn't hear anything of the sort. You know, like with all the people that we were talking to down there, nobody, I don't think, could see that coming. So we just returned back to the United States. We'd been here for about a week when suddenly there was the announcement that, you know, this big Obama was going to make some major announcement. So, yeah, that, you know, it's fortuitous in so many ways. I mean, for the film, it's a wonderful thing because, you know, this year we really launch it starting tomorrow in L.A. So, yeah, it's just, you know, I think over the course of making this film, we've noticed how much people really, you know, are fascinated by Cuba and want to know more. So I think that that sort of interest has always been there. So I kind of think that the film has really been quite fortunate in finding, you know, its audience. But I think obviously in the wake of what Obama said in the last few weeks, you know, that's obviously drawn a lot more attention to the subject. So,
Have you been back down since the announcement?
Not since the announcement, but we were there up until December 5th. So we were there shortly before the announcement was made.
Have you had any contact with any of your...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we spoke to the artists who feature in Alumbrones. And, of course, you know, I think, you know, the emotions for them are so mixed. You know, it's more than 50 years of living life a certain way and sort of going through so much hardship. You know, to come out at the end of that, I think your feelings must be very mixed. I mean, of course, on the one hand, they're elated, they're kind of overjoyed, but I think there's still some sense of shock, you know, especially because I don't think they really saw it coming.
Well, most of them, I mean, I'm guessing there might have been one or two of the artists who might be between 50 and 70, but most of them, it seems like, have grown up their entire lives under the embargo.
Yeah.
And they know nothing else.
Absolutely. So, you know, change is difficult. You know, you become so used to living your life a certain way. And I think it really is a generational thing. You know, I lived in Dublin in the early 2000s when Ireland was going through, you know, kind of a major economic boom. They call it the Celtic Tiger. And I sort of related to this in some ways, even though it hasn't happened yet in Cuba. But I related in some ways because there was so much change in Ireland. There was so much happening. There was some, you know, development going on. But I think it, in a way, it sort of divided the generations. You know, you had the older generation of Irish people who had only ever lived through kind of difficult times in Ireland, you know, had never really known economic prosperity. And then you had the sort of 20-somethings, 30-somethings who, you know, were entering the job market and who could really benefit from you know, all the major changes and booms that were taking place. So I think it's, you know, there was sort of resentment. I could definitely spot resentment from from the older generation to the younger. So, you know, I think there's good and bad to come from this. But I think overwhelmingly it's a good thing. And the response, especially from the artists, has been very positive.
It occurs to me, before we go any further, I should pause here for a minute and point out that you are not American, you are not Cubano,
no.
You are not Irish. You want to fill in what's missing here?
Well, I'm sort of Irish.
Okay, well, all right. I'm sorry.
No, my family's English and Irish, but I'm South African.
Ah.
So, yeah, born and raised in South Africa. Moved to Dublin after I'd finished university. And then whilst I was living in Dublin, had the opportunity to finish my film school studies here in New York. So I've been based in New York ever since.
Excellent. Well, so, I thought that perspective would probably benefit people watching this as we go forward to know, because it would otherwise be a little hard, first of all, to place the accent.
Yeah, I know. You know, people struggle.
You might pass for Cubano if you had a different accent. You look a little Latin there.
Really?
Yeah, I could see a little of that.
I say I haven't heard that one before.
That might just be video Cubans, quality here over Skype, though. I don't know.
Cubans are a real mix, so yeah. You know, I guess there's a place for me there somewhere, but you know.
So, all right, so let's go back to the beginning. What prompted you to study Cuban artists and the art scene there. I mean, there's a million topics in the world. You've obviously seen a good deal of the world. You're in New York studying film, or I mean, you passed that. But you know, why this particular topic?
For me, it was really kind of a coming together of a few things that sort of drew me into this world completely. You know, I'm not, you know, an artist myself. You know, I haven't studied art per se. And, you know, when I had the idea to do the film, I had not yet been to Cuba. So it was, you know, I was really approaching this from the outside. But I had been asked to do a documentary film here in New York for an artist friend of mine. And it was kind of the first step that I'd ever taken into doing something like that. I'd never made a documentary film before. And I just found the process of it liberating. I loved the storytelling in documentary form. So documentary as a genre style of filmmaking, I really kind of turned to. And whilst I was making that, of course, I was becoming more exposed to the art scene and to the art world, and I was introduced to Cuban art whilst doing that, and it really just struck me. You know, I went into a gallery and, you know, that kind of featured all exclusively Cuban art, and you know, there was just an array of work, most of whom actually appear in the film, that I saw kind of on that first day. And the work was so, for me at least, so captivating, so diverse. You know, from one artist to the next, there was so much humor and life and spirit in the work that, you know, for me, I recognize so many stories and lives and character, you know, within all this artwork. So, you know, I was kind of immediately drawn to that. But, you know, coupled with that was sort of this lifelong fascination that I've had with Cuba. And I think I share that with a lot of people. You know, I think when a country or a group is sort of isolated or you don't know much, you kind of, you always harbor this curiosity. You know, you want to know more, you want to explore the subject more. So I think as a filmmaker and eventually as a documentary maker, you know, exploring the unknown is so kind of enticing, you know, and sort of cracking open this world that most people have not seen or visited is, you know, it's a very enticing thing. So, you know, for me, it was just kind of all these separate elements coming together. And it literally was just like a little thunderbolt moment that I had. I mean, I was sitting there on my own having coffee, and I was like, my, you know, sudden interest in the work and kind of documentary filmmaking coupled with a desire to really want to go to Cuba, it just all sort of came together. So,
did you have an easier route to Cuba being a South African citizen as opposed to an American?
Yeah, no, it was certainly much easier. I mean, obviously, I still had to get all the filming permits and sort of go through the process of you know, clearing up all the paperwork. But in terms of traveling there and being welcomed on the island, of course, you know, I had no problems there.
Did you have to fly like through Canada to go?
I flew via Mexico. So just made it easier.
Yeah. So I know that there've been certain permits for journalists to go, but mm-hmm. I mean, you're not a journalist. I don't know if the filmmakers American filmmakers would have had an easier go of it.
Well, interestingly, we're working on another film down there at the moment, and some of the team that I'm working with are Americans. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, it's been easier for them to get their licenses. So it's done through the Office of Foreign Assets Control. So, you know, if you apply through them and you kind of go through all the right procedures, then, you know, it's not impossible to get that done.
Was your production officially monitored? Was there someone from the government either watching you as you worked or insisting on seeing, you know, dailies or anything?
Strangely enough, no. Most of that was kind of done before we arrived, just in terms of providing them with all the necessary information, you know, with where we were going to be, who we were going to talk to, what the subject of the film was. So they, you know, up front, they kind of were looking for, you know, a lot of detail as to what the production was all about. But, you know, certainly once we got there, cleared customs and arrived, there was really, you know, we were certainly unaware of anyone kind of peering over our shoulders and watching what we were doing. I mean, I guess you do sort of get the sense at times that there are kind of watchful eyes on the streets. And you also want to be respectful, even with permits and you know, all the right licenses and that, you're still entering this world, and we've always tried to, you know, tread carefully and be respectful and, you know, not arrive as a huge, you know, overwhelming production, but rather, you know, try to keep it simple, keep it small and as respectful as possible. So
I looked for signs. You have 12 artists, 12 men and women, mm-hmm. Who appear throughout. I looked for signs that maybe they, at some points they might be hesitant to speak for fear of being censored or worse, but didn't see it. I was surprised. Were there times where they said, oh, you know what, can you not use that? I should not have said that.
Well, I mean, interestingly, and this was kind of where editing became a little bit of a struggle because, you know, we had 12 very different people, and some of them were obviously a lot more open about what they, you know, were prepared to talk about. Maybe, again, that was a generational thing. You know, I think with some of the older artists, I think perhaps they felt a little more free in some ways just to kind of say, you know what, I want to say what I want to say. And then you get, you know, kind of the strange ironies where some of them were like, I'm not political, I don't want to talk politics, but I'm going to say this, you know. So, you know, they still found ways to kind of express what they wanted to, but at the same time kind of like covered their tracks as well. And then there were those who definitely kind of steered off the more sensitive topics. And, you know, we certainly weren't looking to push them into saying anything that they didn't feel comfortable with. But the trick in the end was they all came together. You know what I mean? So to allow one person to say what was on their mind and then kind of couple them with someone else who was not really open to talk, you know, it's kind of a very delicate balance to get right, because you obviously want to respect some of their desires to be open and to, you know, feel free to say what they want, but you also want to be mindful and respectful of those who kind of would rather sort of stay out. So, you know, we went back to Havana after having completed the film, and we had a screening with everybody, all the artists, their friends and families, and, you know, it was a great gathering. And it was sort of my first question to them when we finished watching the film was, you know, before this film goes out, before I submit it anywhere, you know, do you all feel comfortable? Have I really crossed the line with any of you? Or do you think there's a subject here that really is just, you know, taboo? Like, we really shouldn't say it. And I think the film kind of gets close to the line at points, you know, and I think makes references that a lot of Cubans will get that is not necessarily something that's obvious to an outside audience, but they kind of, they're referencing something that is, you know, quite a strong point. But strangely enough, I think their response was basically that, I think in the last, let's say 10 years, things have, the grip has sort of loosened quite significantly. Not to say that you're free to do and say what you please by any means, but I think, you know, there's just a little more room to breathe. So,
do you think will Alan Bronis be shown in Cuba?
We still don't really know. I mean, we tried to show it in Havana, but, you know, again, it definitely touches on certain, you know, subjects and it raises certain issues that I think the government would still be very uncomfortable with. So I really hope that we can. You know, we have had screenings there, but they've been kind of more private. But I think for, you know, for any film to sort of show at the Havana Film Festival and that, I mean, it's obviously got to get approval. It's got to be sort of widely acknowledged and approved there. So I think that's, you know, there's still a little way to go before that happens. But, you know, in light of what's been happening over the last few weeks, I don't feel like we're that far off necessarily from showing the film.
So. How did you select the 12 men and women that are seen in Alan Broner's?
I hadn't actually selected any of them until after I'd actually made my first trip to Cuba, which was in early 2012. And, you know, I went down there, I met many of them. You know, some of them I loved their work. For instance, Pedro Pablo Oliva, the oldest artist in the film. I mean, he's easily Cuba's most famous living artist today, and his work is just, it's really overwhelming and quite, you know, it's really unbelievable. So, and his was actually the first painting I saw as I, you know, as I walked into this gallery. So, you know, I wanted him to be in the film really, really badly, but he was the one person I thought might not be in the film just because of his status there and you know, how high profile he is. But it really surprised us, and kind of he really honored us by wanting to be a part of this project. So, as you know, some of them were definitely selected just because I absolutely loved their work. I really, really loved their work. Fortunately, when we were there, the four young boys who appear in the film were introduced to us by one of the artists in the film, Adele Bordone. They're actually students of his. So while we were there and sort of preparing for everything, he said to me, there are four young guys you just have to meet. And, you know, they're brilliant artists. They're full of energy, full of creativity and passion, and really smart. So they were a real gift. You know, I hadn't seen their work. I didn't know of them until I had actually arrived on the island. So, you know, it was kind of a piecing together that sort of happened, you know, in many, many different ways. But I also liked the diversity. You know, I didn't also want to get too many people who were kind of the same ilk. So I think the film also has kind of a really nice wide range of you know, different artists, which is not only interesting from an artistic point of view, but I think from a storytelling point of view, you know, and to really try, you know, really get a cross section of what Cubans are like, from men and women to older and younger. You know, those four boys, you know, with all the screenings we've had and people we've spoken to about the film, so many people are just so fascinated by them. You know, they were 19, 20 years old when we interviewed them. And so smart, as I said, you know, so creative, so talented, and really just kind of knocked our socks off, and very worldly. And here they were, four young guys sharing a one-bedroom apartment, you know, most of the time with no electricity and no money, no food, you know, to speak of, really. And, you know, their absolute passion and desire was to produce artwork. And they talk about it in the film, and it's just like, that's what drives them. They just want to keep pushing and pushing and do the best work that they can. And that's their struggle. And it's fascinating, I think, because a lot of people compare them to 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds elsewhere around the world, in America or Europe, and, you know, and it's just, in so many ways, it's a relief to have, you know, four young kids, basically, who are just so in touch with the world and with themselves and, you know, just so driven, really, really so driven and so smart. So, you know, I think they really stand out in so many ways.
They're very well spoken. They're very they were very interesting. They played off of each other well.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. One of the things I wondered is, did you start off with a larger group, or did these people, the 12?
Yeah,
that was it.
Not really. Well, there were kind of a few others that were sort of possibly, you know, going to appear in the film. But it wasn't necessarily something that I deliberated over for the longest time, and kind of, you know, it just felt right. You know, we had a group that came together, and it felt like the right group and a good number. I think if it was more than 12, we would have struggled, because already there were a lot of stories to tell. There are a lot of kind of, you know, angles to the film. And, you know, I didn't want it to drift on for 2-3 hours, you know. I mean, we certainly could have. I mean, the alternative was to sort of break it up into smaller pieces and to try approach it from a very different point of view, which was kind of tell each person's story on their own. But I like the idea that we have a full range of people that all come together and sort of contrast each other and as you say, like play off each other in many ways. I just think it makes for a more dynamic and interesting way to kind of present the story and to tell all their stories. But also, you know, why it was so good to kind of bring them all together is because, interestingly enough, there were so many subjects that when we started making the film, we weren't necessarily aware of them being kind of key subjects to the film. But in talking to everyone, we realized there were so many things that kind of connected them to each other, you know, which sort of made putting them all together, you know, as I said, that bit more interesting. You know, every time we sat down for an interview, they spoke so much about the special period. And as you know, that comes up in the film again and again. And what that is basically when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba lost 90% of its trade literally overnight, you know.
And foreign aid, not just trade, but I mean, the money, that had propped it up for decades.
Absolutely. So, you know, they describe this period of kind of being in between, you know, the former Soviet Union and the embargo, and they really had nothing. You know, they had no one to turn to. And of course, this affected the whole island. But interestingly enough, you know, the artists talk about how it affected them, you know, in their personal lives, with their families, but also, you know, artistically speaking, you know, as you mentioned earlier, sometimes there's just no resources whatsoever. You know, so no pens, no paper, no, you know, no paints, no canvases, nothing. So, you know, it really fueled their creativity. And they speak about, you know, doing installation work out in the fields using rocks and dirt and leaves. And, you know, so it really pushed them to be as creative as possible and to find, you know, materials using whatever it was that they had available to them. And recycling is another thing as well. So, you know, reusing, you know, paper, cardboard, glass, you know, all these sorts of things to, you know, nothing was going to stop them from producing art, which is, you know, a really, really wonderful thing. So they just had to find ways of going around it, going through it, using what they had. So it's, you know, it's really fascinating.
I want to ask you a pair of production questions. Mm-hmm. The film is entirely in Spanish with subtitles. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had thought about, or if there would be a version of it that would be, you know, with a narrator who, or series of narrators in different voices who would be speaking, you know, the artist's words in English to make it a little more accessible, or why the decision to do all Spanish.
Well, actually, you know, some of the artists do speak a bit of English, and you know, during some of the interviews, they were starting to speak in English. But I thought better to just be more consistent, you know, throughout. You know, that's certainly a possibility, I guess, to dub it. I'm not necessarily a big fan of dubbing, and I especially like the fact that the Cubans have, you know, such a unique accent and tone and humor in the way that they speak. And, you know, even in simple translations, there's a lot that is lost. You know, we tried as best as possible to kind of be as true to what they were saying. But, you know, as one example, they talk about the diversity of you know, the cultures and races and ethnicities and all that in Cuba. And Adele Bordone uses the expression, and the mother of the tomatoes, you know, which was the direct translation of what he was saying, but it sort of means, and the kitchen sink and everything else thrown in, you know. But whenever we watch that with a Cuban audience, they laugh like crazy because they get the reference, you know. But an English audience wouldn't necessarily get the reference. You know, I guess to translate it to dub it is definitely a possibility. We're actually preparing the film for that eventuality. So, you know, we're kind of working with the sound to be able to do that. So
if I could offer, I know you debut in LA tomorrow, so it's kind of mm-hmm. pointless, but I'm just give you this bit of feedback. What I found is, because I, you know, I watched the film, having to read the subtitles for mm-hmm. 75 minutes did not allow me enough time to actually look at their art.
Yeah.
I found myself looking at the bottom of the screen most of the time and reading mm-hmm. when what I really wanted to be doing was listening with my ears and looking at the art through the whole film. So
yeah.
For what it's worth, for a film about art and artists, I didn't get to really appreciate enough of their art because I was so yeah. busy focused on reading.
No, that's absolutely a very fair point. I mean, if we can dub it into English and if that's, you know, the best thing for the audience, then, you know, for sure.
Right, so
or just watch it again and again.
Well, yeah. So, if only there was that much time in the day.
Exactly.
Now, the other production question I had is that you don't actually identify the participating artists until the very end. And throughout most of it, I thought maybe it was an effort to protect them in some ways because as we're going through, I mean, for example, because I am reading, the subtitles and as mm-hmm. someone who's going to talk to you, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what I want to ask you about. I did not have their names. I couldn't connect their names to what they were saying. And then at the end in the credits, we get their names. I was just curious what the decision there was.
Well, I mean, we tried actually when we were in post-production. We wanted to put the names directly up on the screen. But, you know, this again, it comes back to the subtitles. So for the purely kind of Spanish version or wherever we don't have subtitles, you know, I'd be obviously more than happy to put the names up on screen. But the problem was, again, you know, you have subtitles and then a name and person talking and then this, you know, you're cutting away to something else and you're trying to look at the scenery or the artwork. So we tested it. We did test it, and we just found that there was too much going on the screen, you know, all at the same time. So it was kind of, you know, an aesthetic thing. It was a technical thing, I guess. And I knew that if people were reading the subtitles, they would miss the name or vice versa. And I kind of thought, well, you know, what's the best solution to this? So, you know, I mean, it is something that has come up from time to time. So, you know, I guess we could definitely find ways of trying to put everything on screen at the same time. But to me, it just felt cluttered. And I, you know, through all that deliberation, I kind of thought, well, it'll be a wonderful thing to, at the end of the film, kind of have a little video clip and the name of each artist. And I like that because it's sort of, it gives each artist, again, sort of a personal thank you. You know, it's sort of our way of thanking the artists and acknowledging them right at the end of the film. And I also think, you know, when someone is sitting in an audience, you know, if one of the artists appeared in the first 2-3 minutes of the film and the name came up, but they didn't come up again, you know, by the time you've sat through 75 minutes, you would have probably forgotten the name of the artist, you know, who appeared kind of early on. So I sort of also like the fact that, you know, before any other credits really begin to roll, you know, we see all the artists and get their names. So I like that sort of as you're walking out, you're sort of reminded of who they are and kind of can walk away with that. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, it's not an easy thing. And it's, especially, as you say, with having subtitles on the screen, it just, it all became quite cluttered. But it was, you know, for no other reason really than that. So
I want to ask you about some specific quotes that I wrote down that different artists said. And again, I apologize to them because I can't attribute these to names. You'll know who said them because you've sat in the editing suite, I'm sure, hundreds of hours. But I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the things that they said. The first one is, and this is very early in the film, it's easy to become a surrealist in Cuba.
That is Luis Rodriguez Noa. Again, just, you know, his work is just amongst my favorite. I have I've collected quite a bit of his work. He designed the poster for the film as well. And, you know, his work particularly is very kind of surrealist and there's a lot of humor to his artwork. But I like the way Noah works, especially because he kind of tends to only work at night. He's a real night owl. But his work, you know, normally starts off with just a plain canvas, be it red, yellow, white, whatever it is. It's sort of like the solid canvas. And then he's sort of developed his own language. It's kind of like this hieroglyphs. But it's sort of a stream of consciousness. So whatever he's thinking about, whatever he hears, whatever he sees, while he's working, sort of all finds a place somewhere on the canvas. And his studio is in central Havana, which, if anyone has been, knows the chaos that is central Havana. It's a really kind of old part of the city, and just, I mean, beautiful. It's you're probably familiar with a lot of the sites because it's, you know, it appears in you know, a lot of images and postcards and films and that sort of thing. But all sorts of noise and chaos and, you know, activity out in the streets and in the houses, and just nothing slows down day or night. So it's kind of, it is a bizarre world, you know, and again, as Noah says in the film, it's just everyone in Havana is just always going around, like, you know, looking like they're so busy, but they're trying to find something to do. You know what I mean?
Or to eat, or
whatever the case, you know, just surviving and thriving and just, you know, always kind of having to think, always having to kind of be on the move. So it's, you know, it's a strange environment, you know, and especially where he is, you know, in central Havana, it's chaos. It's like this condensed life, you know. So it's incredible.
Yeah. How about this? Everything we do is fueled by what's already here.
Everything we do. I don't know who said that.
It was one of the young men. What he was, what I thought he was saying.
Sorry. I know. He's talking about not having access to the internet. Okay, sorry. Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, well, I mean, it's something, again, referring to the four boys. I think they especially really feel the impact of not really having access to the internet. You know, I mean, over the last couple of years, they've introduced, you know, high-speed internet access onto the island, but it's not really accessible. You know, it's hugely expensive to be on the internet there for, you know, just an hour. It equates to almost a third of their monthly wages to be online for an hour. So, you know, it's there, but it's not accessible. So what he's referring to really is kind of this lack of information, you know, and I think the internet really is probably the biggest kind of information drought that they have there, really. And he's talking more, you know, specifically about artwork, where Cuban artists tend to turn to each other for ideas, for inspiration. They reference each other's work all the time, but they don't have as much exposure to the outside world of art. you know, to what is currently on the scene, to, you know, the sort of latest influences and that sort of thing. So, you know, I think they feel inhibited in many ways, restricted, you know, and stunted is probably the word.
That was the way I took it, that they're just not seeing. I mean, I can go to downtown St. Petersburg and there's several dozen galleries of the latest art and artists, local and national and international.
Exactly. I mean, there's a huge art scene in Cuba, and of course, you know, the art schools across the country, and you know, it's so well developed in so many ways, you know, the art scene, but it is very local.
Right. It hasn't.
You know what I mean?
They have not been exposed. I mean, one of the artists is kind of plaintive about MoMA and artists in MoMA. I don't know that he had ever been to MoMA, but certainly he was aware of MoMA.
He has traveled, because some of the artists have, you know, have traveled outside of Cuba, shown their work outside of Cuba. So, you know, that artists generally, you know, as Cubans go, certainly in the last 20 years, have kind of benefited from, you know, the government sort of allowing them a little more access to being able to travel, being able to kind of sell their work outside outside the island. You know, so they have had a little bit more exposure. But, you know, this quote that you gave came from one of the four young boys. And I think, you know, they sort of have that frustration and that kind of rage in them because, you know, they just want to get out there. They want to be a part of the art scene and what is currently happening, you know, especially that they're at school. You know, they're still, well, at the art school. So I think they're just sort of, they're so kind of enticed and teased by this idea of you know, the world outside of theirs.
Well, should trade really open up, they will probably find they are in high demand because
absolutely
the art world is always looking for something it hasn't seen or it doesn't have. Or
absolutely, and I think they, you know, especially being, you know, 20, 21 years old, I think they have a huge advantage of being able to kind of ride that wave and get out there and have a lot more years ahead of them to really sort of become involved. So I hope that's the case.
Another one of the moments I really enjoyed was the woman who says that she would like for one day for Cuban art to be as recognized as to be as indigenous to Cuba as coffee or rum. I like
that. Yeah, that was Sandra Dooley at the end. Yeah,
very nice thought. If you had it to do over, as we kind of wrap up here, would you have chosen a less complicated project, or do you think that it was just as it turned out, especially as you near distribution tomorrow, it was just it was meant to be. The timing could not have been better.
I definitely wouldn't have chosen anything easier. I mean, I know filmmaking is usually kind of, you know, clouded with all sorts of complications and struggles and that sort of thing, but it felt good. You know, making this film from start to finish really felt good. And all the people who came on board, I mean, we haven't spoken about my producing partner, Fermin Rojas. He's Cuban-born, now living in the United States. I met him on my first trip down to Cuba, and, you know, it was his first time going back since he was 6 years old. And he reconnected with the island and with the, you know, with the people there and with the artists who we interviewed in such a strong and kind of powerful, overwhelming way that I, you know, on our first trip down there, I said to him, and he was not a filmmaker, you know, he's not involved in filmmaking at all, up until that point. And I just said to him, you know, I'm coming back here in a few months to start filming, and you're definitely coming with me. Like, I don't know what other plans you have, but I really want you to be involved in this project. And, you know, he brought so much to it as well. His reconnecting to you know, what is really his home, and the people there. I mean, you know, he conducted all the interviews with the artists, and I wouldn't have had it any other way because they felt comfortable with him. Not that they didn't with me, but I knew that they spoke a particular language that, you know, would allow the film to go that much deeper. You know, whereas I think if they were talking to me directly, maybe they would be more polite or approach everything in a way that kind of made sense to me as an outsider, but I didn't necessarily want that. So, so yeah, that was a, you know, that was a huge positive, you know, one of the real positive things that came out of making this film. So, you know, the technical side of making the film was not easy, and filming in Cuba is never really easy. You know, there's just, you know, you cannot fix things there really, or replace things easily, or get around that easily. You know, when you're there, they're trying to accommodate you as best they can, but it's always a struggle. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's never quite as simple. And of course, I live in New York now, so it's like the polar opposite. But yeah, I mean, just in terms of the people who came together to make this film, you know, and everything that was poured into it, I wouldn't have had it any other way.
You know? Final question: as mm-hmm. you think back on your experience making Alambrones, and the political change that's apparently percolating and about to really take over in a big way, mm-hmm. has it crossed your mind that you captured a moment in time there that may not exist again in 3 to 5, 10 years? I mean.
It was something that definitely was on my mind, you know, during the making of the film, and you know, I'd say, you know, since having completed it, but I didn't know how significant that was going to be, because I didn't know really how much longer this would all go on for, you know. And but of course, you know, when that announcement was made, and I realized things are going to take a long time to change, you know, and I think anyone who's been there will realize that it's not going to happen overnight. You know, but certainly politically speaking, the significance of it is enormous. And I think it's really a matter of the wheels really beginning to turn. So I kind of think that we've sort of already crossed that line, even though, you know, there's still so far to go. I think that line has now been crossed. So I feel like Alambrones is now already kind of in this sort of time capsule, because I don't think things are ever going to be the same. You know, as long as it will take to change, I still don't think anything is going to be the same as it was up until a few weeks ago, you know. So for sure, yeah.
Well, folks, you can find out when Bruce Donnelly's new documentary about the artist's life in Cuba, Alambrones, will be at a theater near you by going to its website.
I also want to say we're opening on iTunes. It's going to be released on iTunes as well. So
you're skipping ahead in my script here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Apologies.
You can find out about live screenings, so to speak, at alambrones.com. It's alumbrones.com. If you're watching the video, you've been seeing it along the bottom. If you're listening to this as an audio podcast, that's why I spelled it out. And as my guest pointed out, you can also download it via video on demand as of tomorrow or Friday, January 16th, from iTunes, Xbox, PlayStation, Amazon, and Vimeo. Correct?
Correct.
See that? I come prepared.
Okay.
So we've given the website. Are you or the film up on Twitter, Facebook, other social media?
All of those things. Yeah, we're on Facebook. I think you just need to type in Alambrones and you'll find us on Facebook. That and Twitter as well. It's at Alambrones. So, yeah, and you'll get regular updates. The LA screening is, as I said, tomorrow, and that's hopefully one of many we'll be having. So yeah, we'll give all live updates and feeds from there.
Very good.
So yeah.
Well, fascinating film, really enlightening, and my God, the timing!
Yeah,
you're a very lucky man, because had that announcement not been made, it would have just been one more film in a documentary. See, instead, mm-hmm. you've got that Cuban film that's just opening on the edge of this. So congratulations
sure.
on that.
Thank you.
Bruce Donnelly, thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you so much, Bob. That was great. Thank you.
Streets now. Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, the reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.